My name is Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And this is Edge Cases, a podcast about mostly Apple-related software development. This is episode 19. We're recording on Friday, September 21st, 2012. What's our topic this week, Will?
Concurrency, with the emphasis on con.
Concurrency.
Yes.
As they say. So for our listeners, this is the second episode in a row where Wolf has a topic because a couple episodes ago, Wolf went away for a bit. So, and then I had two episodes in a row. So we are now writing the universe, as it were. And so here we go. So this is an odd episode. So this would be your normal topic week. And then we'll go back to each of us going back and forth as before.
Right. I'm glad you put that in terms that a two-year-old can understand, that, you know, Wolf went away for a while.
Yes. I'm running out of euphemisms. Alrighty. So take it away.
Okay. Yeah. So I have a lot on my screen here, so I'm hoping I can condense this down to 45 minutes. So this is going to be kind of high level, and I'll also strive to speak very, very quickly. Okay. So topic is concurrency, with the emphasis on con. So basically, I want to kind of give a survey of the landscape of all the concurrent options available to modern programmers, and talk about the problems with all of them. So if you guys are holding out, having your favorite in the race here, I'm probably going to talk trash about it, at least a little bit.
Woo!
So I'm kind of saying, like, setting the tone for the show here is that Herb Sutter, back in 2005, wrote the seminal Dr. Dobbs article, which was titled "The Free Lunch is Over." And did you read this article, Andrew?
I don't remember it offhand, no.
Okay. It's basically, he wrote about how, again, remember, this was back in 2005, and he said, essentially, you notice how all the processors, how we've been kind of like stuck at 3 gigahertz for a while, and... You know, of course, nowadays, like, we're lucky to have 3 gigahertz processors. Like, I don't even know what I have in my air here. Let me check. It's, it's 1.8 gigahertz, so I'm way below that. But it used to be that, you know, the processors of this would increase in basically clock speed, and mostly with attendant performance increase. Of course, I think Intel was pretty famous for some versions of their Celeron. They would, like, crank up the gigahertz ratings, but actually didn't buy you all that much speed. But pretty much, there was some sort of comparison. In fact, that was even the megahertz myth. Or do you remember that, Andrew?
I remember something like that, yeah.
Okay, that was when the poor G4s were stuck at, like, 400 megahertz for 40 years. And so Apple wanted to say, oh, our processor is very fast. This is fast Intel, guys. You don't have to worry about it. And they had the Intel and the dancing bunny suits and all that. Anyway, that's totally not on my notes, so this is not doing well so far with me. I did not put dancing bunny suits on my notes. Anyway, so this article was written in 2005, but it's really great because Herb updated the graphs 2009 that pretty much proves his point. But his if you look at the graphs he provides, essentially, that straight line speed, single core speed, is not improving. We are getting more transistors. If you look at the chart of the number of transistors we're having in processors, it is continuing to improve, as you would expect with die shrinks and finer engraving processes and all that. But you notice that our processors seem kind of stalled in terms of the megahertz and gigahertz ratings. I mean, they're definitely faster. I mean, the architectures are improving, obviously. Is this the kind of the Moore's Law kind of every 18 months that we get straight line doubling of speed is isn't holding anymore. And what is happening is that our processors are getting wider. So I said, you know, my MacBook Air here has a 1.7 or 1.8 gigahertz processor, and but it actually has 4 logical cores in it, so it's gotten wider. And so this kind of brings into the point. Well, so his entire thing is that, based on the title of his article, is that we used to kind of, you know, programmers, like, we all we had to do was write software and then kick our heels back, and every 18 months our software get twice fast, so then we could piss it away again and write in even higher level languages that aren't actually that high level. And so now we have to, now we actually have to work for our speed increases. And so what this topic is about is pretty much the bevy of options we have and the problems with all of them. So first let me start at kind of the hardware level, so we can kind of couch this in terms of what, like, our physical reality is about. And so obviously we have a processor. And the first way to be able to do more than one thing at a time is to go multiprocessor. Back in, it used to be like the SMP, the symmetric multiprocessing, was the big thing. Apple ships symmetric multiprocessing system. And they've been doing that, I think, even in, if not Apple, then, I mean, even back in the 68K days, where people would bolt multiple processors together. So that's totally not new. So we've been, but it wasn't widespread. What's far more widespread today is multi-core, which is putting multiple. It's almost like multiprocessor, except you have the cores of the processor put onto one die. So, for example, I mentioned I have four logical cores in my MacBook Air. Those are logical; those aren't physical. I'll talk a little bit about that later. But I mean, even the lowly iPhone has so this is, I guess, our first episode recorded since the iPhone 5 has shipped. And so that's a dual core processor in there. It's the A6. And MacRumors just came out and pointed to, apparently it's a 3-core GPU is in it. So cores abound even on the little portable phones, cellular phones. So I mentioned the logical core type stuff. So I'm pretty sure the i7 that's in my MacBook Air has 2 cores in it. But it tells the operating system, hey, I have 4 cores. And the reason for this is a technology called simultaneous multithreading, although Intel has deemed their version of it hyperthreading.
Hyperthreading, right. I remember that term.
Yeah. So do you know how hyperthreading works, or some simultaneous multithreading works?
Well, just in the sense that it has to, it pretends to be the multiple cores because it can handle the extra work with the existing cores.
Exactly. It's lying to the operating system, so the operating system will try to feed it multiple instruction streams at once. So I'm pretty sure I have 2 cores, and both cores are trying to handle 2 simultaneous instruction streams. And essentially what happens is that you have the pipeline, and as it's looking at instructions, as it's able, I mean, the register set, it actually has 4 register sets, probably even more, virtualized and all that. But those instruction streams flowing through is that it can interleave those instructions across the hardware it has, and then it can, even when, like, stalls happen on memory accesses, it can then satisfy the other stream that might be doing something with what's in the registry memory and so forth. So it's actually a pretty cool trick, and it works pretty well. So it's been a good way to squeeze a lot more performance, and it's been surprisingly compatible with operating systems out there. It's pretty much a big win. And of course, when you're talking about concurrency and all that, you kind of have to also talk about GPUs nowadays. So I have my lowly little MacBook Air, which has crappy Intel integrated graphics, has, I think it was like HD 3000 something in there. But it has 12 stream processors. And those stream processors are basically kind of like vector units. And that they, so it has 12 of them. And this is probably in one core, I don't know for sure. I mean, it's integrated, so it's probably integrated with the chipset itself. So my lowly little MacBook Air here has 12 stream processors. I looked it up, and my Mac Pro, which is not the latest, but it's, Mac Pros, I guess, age pretty well, because they don't ship too many updates to them. GPU that came with it has 32 CUDA cores, is an NVIDIA graphics card. And apparently the new Mac Pro has an ATI Radeon HD option that has between 800 and 1600 functional units in it. So those aren't cores. Unfortunately, like the simple idea of like having cores seems to be breaking down now. I'm not really too up on this, but But you can just figure out there's probably a lot of cores going on there if they're having that many. If you're having 1,600 functional units, I can't imagine you're putting that at least in two cores, although I don't really know the infrastructure nowadays. So my point is that we have a lot of overbuilt concurrent hardware just sitting in our little lowly MacBook Airs and our iPhones, and obviously the beefier hardware has yet even more. So basically the hardware is ready for the concurrent present, and the question is, how do we get our software to that?
Right.
So at the software level, there's various ways to deal with concurrency. And at the lowest level are interrupts. And those are the things where it's like there's a clock chip that every so many milliseconds, or probably microseconds, definitely microseconds, it will assert a pin on the processor, and the processor will stop, take note of it, and say, oh, you know, a microsecond has gone by, usually probably groups of them or something. And the interrupt is really primitive in that when the processor is working, it notices that when the lines is asserted, and what it does is it takes the current register set, it pushes it onto the stack as it exists right now, and then it jumps to a predefined address in memory. So that's pretty primitive, and that address is nowadays pretty much always in protected memory kernel. And that's actually probably the big problem with interrupts, is that the big con with them is that nowadays they're kernel only, that they're really meant for handling like devices like the clock chip, some DMA transfers, stuff like that. And of course they're also preemptive in that you don't know what you were doing when that signal was asserted, and now that gets preempted. And preemption has a couple of, well, probably more than a couple, but has some undesirable effects that we'll talk about later. So at the very lowest level, you have interrupts. And that's actually what tends to be at the operating system level and is what it was pretty much what everything else is built on top of. So it's important how they're simple, but it's important to understand how they work and what they do.
So I feel like I should interrupt you like I just did to demonstrate how they work. But yes.
It took me a while to figure that out. See, that's the other problem, interrupt latency. Anyway. What we tend to deal with in the first level of common concurrency are processes. And that, you know, modern Unix operating system, I use modern in scare quotes, by the way, because I don't think Unix is very modern, but anyway. We have processes, and a process is basically an address space that includes a heap, at least one stack, and a set of file descriptors, like what files we have open. They're pretty heavyweight processes. Typically, they're kind of the lumbering elephants of concurrency. They're pretty much the heaviest thing. Yeah, I guess they are the heaviest thing that your operating system does. And then back in the bad old days of web servers, the programs that would vend your HTML forms or whatever, they would often be written using this technology called CGI, for Common Gateway Interface. And what would happen is that the web server would get this HTTP request and would actually spawn a process to handle this one HTTP request, and then you could write in Perl or write in C, what have you. But this turned out to be launching a process is pretty much the worst thing you can ask the operating system to do, because it's pretty heavyweight. I mean, you just click on an icon in the Finder, right, and count the number of times it bounces in your dock. Operating system, there's a lot of work to bring all those pages into memory and set up everything, and they also take up a lot of memory. So so you tend to have probably between 1,000 and probably a maximum of 1,000 to, if you're lucky, 10,000 processes per machine. And so those are pretty heavyweight. Even on beefy machines, you're probably not going to be running too many of those. But the good thing about them is that they are very, when one crashes, it's totally isolated. It doesn't take down the rest of your machine. The operating systems tend to have, different operating systems have different IPC, interprocess communication abilities, but usually it's pretty good. And so it's a pretty nice, I mean, you can tie them to sockets. It's a pretty nice conceptual unit, logical unit of work that they have a lot of desirable stuff. But again, main problem is that they're pretty heavyweight. So then we kind of move on to threads. And you can think of a thread as less than a process. It's basically a stack, and it's a register set. And it shares the address space with other threads. And of course, that also means it shares the heap. And as a matter of fact, in Mach, the operating system kernel of Mac OS X and iOS, the definition of a Mach process is an address space, a heap, a set of Mach ports, and a set of threads. So it was, from the get-go, had this idea that a process was n threads, or one or more threads, I guess. So that's a pretty modern interpretation of what a process should be, and I think it's a great conceptual model. And, of course, the main problem with threads is, you know, I mentioned that they're much lighter weight, and you can have a lot more of them than you can have processes. However, they're probably their main con is that they share address space, and it's really a double-edged sword. So you have these separate logical units, but they all share the same address space, so they can happily read and write to each other's memory. On one side, this makes communicating between the threads very easy. If you want to communicate through processes, you typically have to do some sort of serialization thing where you have this message and you serialize it over and you send it across the wire. It might be local, it might be maybe undistributed, but it tends to be a big deal. With in the magical world of threads, all you have to do is modify the memory in place and the other thread will see it. This unfortunately leads to unpredictable of behavior. In fact, something as simple as incrementing a shared counter can fail. So if, like, you have this one integer that says you're tracking how many connections you currently have on your socket, and multiple threads are dealing with them, and you increment it for each connection, and you decrement for each disconnect, like, that can go wrong. That's a simple little plus plus minus minus. And that's because in the PowerPC, it was very straightforward, or other RISC processors, you had a load and store instructions, and they were separate. And how an increment actually would work is that you'd do a load, and then you'd increment it in the register, and then you'd do the store. Problem is that while you were doing that three-phase operation, someone else could have loaded the same integer, incremented, and stored it. And so you'd overlap. If you're unlucky, you'd overlap in a way that you actually would lose an increment or lose a decrement. The Intel architecture has direct memory access instructions, so it looks like that can't happen, but it also can happen as well. So there's a bunch of ways to deal with this, but that's beyond the scope of what we want to talk about here. I should mention, typically that means that you need to use locks. And in earlier Objective-C, you had to write all your locks manually. Nowadays, we have the @synchronized syntax, whatever you call it, language extension, whatever. And mostly sweeps under the rug for you that of a lot of the kind of hard stuff to deal with, like if you throw an exception, make sure you unlock, that type of stuff. And so it's the locks stuff tends to be really hard. So I think it was Damien Katz, the creator of CouchDB, and I guess now Couchbase, but he had a tweet recently which is like, you know, the beginner says threads are hard. The intermediate says, oh, locks are okay. I mean, threads are hard. The intermediate says, threads are okay. And the expert says, threads are hard. It's one of these things where initially you look at threads and you say, this is really hard to figure out all the problems. And then once you deal with them enough, you think, okay, I know what all the problems are here. I know I can deal with all the edge cases. And it's only after, like, you've shipped software that has these unreproducible bugs that torment you for 4 weeks on end, do you end up understanding, like, basically the limits of human thought, that it's very hard to think about things when things can happen out of order that you never thought could.
Yeah, this hasn't usually hit UI programmers in the past on the Mac, but with all the animation that you can do now, that's so easy to do on iOS and Mac with Core Animation, it's much easier for you to hit these cases where, wait, so three or four things could be happening right now, and you have to be sure that any combination of them happening will still work out correctly for you.
Yeah. Do you know of Core Animation? I know it uses some threading for like the interpolation stuff like that, but do you know how much of it is actually done on the main thread versus background threads? I imagine shifts from OS to OS, but
I think it does. I think it can do stuff on other threads. I mean, in the end, it's still all tied to the main thread in terms of when the UI updates. But I think it can do some of its stuff off the main thread that can make it weird for you because you say, well, all right, you know, you're updating this frame when, and it could be happening before or after something that you might have thought would have been more serial. But it's true. I don't know too much more of it than that.
I will say that the goal model of Core Animation, where you say I want this thing over here, and it does the rest. It really helps because you can see that, you know, it's pretty much it does the correct thing that I want to do, even though I don't know how it's doing it. So I'm sure they're using threads right in the background, but who knows? Maybe initially it wasn't very threaded, but they were able to keep on ratcheting up the optimization there, and it's high level enough that they can swap implementations. Pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I was talking about how like even things like simply incrementing a shared counter can go wrong with threads. I should couch that to say that is preemptive threading. And macOS old-timers will remember a thread manager offered cooperative threads. So cooperative threads work pretty much just like preemptive threads, except you do not get preempted. Instead, your thread runs into the point where you call a function. In the old thread manager days, that was called yield to any thread, or you could also yield to a specific thread, but usually this could yield to any thread. And so in that case, even if you have a shared counter, and so long as the only thing that was touching it were those cooperative threads, you couldn't get like the lost write or the lost increment or lost decrement problem that plagues preemptive threads. So that's a little thing to stick in your mind as we go through these other options, because you'll see this recurring. So another thing I want to talk about is run loops. Have you had to tangle much with run loops, Andrew?
Some. Mostly in dealing with scheduling things as opposed to like dealing with I/O or something like that. I mean, run loops can do a whole huge amount of things. So I've only done some things with it. But yeah, normally, you know, you wanna schedule something for later. And this will, you know, if you want to dig down deeper into like your timers or whatever, then you need to know something about run loops.
Yeah, run loops was in terms of like, it's weird because like when I was learning Mac OS X and programming Mac OS X, run loops was probably the biggest mystery to me and remain a mystery, because run loops is one of these things where you can use them pretty effectively without really understanding why they exist or how they work, whatever. You just kind of follow APIs and do it, and things mostly magically happen correctly.
And they've changed because having them handle blocks, having them handle GCD has, I believe that they just act, they either act differently or there's different things that can happen when you use them with GCD and blocks versus when you use them with regular stuff.
Absolutely. It's kind of like how NS operation queues, like guts, were re-implemented on top of GCD. You almost can think of them as, I guess, a superset of GCD now, like a higher level API for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned run loops because they're confusing. I mean, we probably actually should probably just have an episode on that. Although Quinn the Eskimo gave a great talk about run loops at, I think, DubDub 2010, something like that. I don't even know if I can possibly link to it because of the way Apple's developer site works. But anyway, just in general, if you If you're at DubDub and there's a session by Quinn, you should go watch it.
Right.
Quinn's an old timer. He knows what he speaks of. And so run loops, I should mention as a preface that it is, they're not strictly concurrent. They're all about basically kind of serial execution of things. However, because computers are so blasted fast, they kind of feel having to do with concurrency. So it's kind of in the same boat as like the cooperative thread manager of yore. And what's interesting is that run loops and those types of systems where you have kind of a list of things to do and you kind of knock them off as you go, it works really, really, really well. For example, have you heard of Nginx, Andrew?
Nginx?
Yes.
Nope.
Okay. Nginx is a web server there's this thing called the C10K problem, and it stands for 10,000 concurrent connections. And it was written by, you know, I forget who did it, darn, it's not in my notes, but I'll link to it, is kind of this theoretical problem. It's like, what would it take for a piece of software to be able to handle 10,000 concurrent connections? And I believe at the time it was written, it was basically infeasible. It was like, you know, no one can do that. It's just, you know, we don't have the software. I don't think it was even a matter of like the hardware. I think the hardware is capable of even back then, but we didn't have the software model for it. And Nginx and is written, and also Node.js has this idea of kind of this event loop where you take a request and you do this little thing and like take a request and then you like maybe need to stat the file system or to figure out what files serve off. Where that you waiting for that disk. Disks are really, really, really slow. So what you do is that you say, okay, give me a callback when you're done restating the file system. You get your stat back, like, okay, I'm going to open the file. I'm maybe even going to do that synchronously. So it's very synchronous. Did you have the pleasure of using the old PB async routines of the classic of the Carbon Mac toolbox?
Oh, you know what? I did. I did use some of those, yeah.
It's pretty much the same thing. As a matter of fact, Chris Hansen had a good post about how all of this is kind of this, like, basically dredges up the old macOS model, which was surprisingly advanced in today's terms. But anyway, the both Nginx and Node have this idea that you pretty callback heavy, do everything you can asynchronously, and in that way you don't actually even, you can have this one thread, but computers, amazing enough, because they're all robotic, can juggle 10,000 balls at once. And that's pretty impressive. So, and the nice thing about this model is that you don't have the problems of the preemptive shared memory problems that you only have one thread of execution. So a lot of the kind of conceptual problems of preemptive multitasking, they don't happen. Of course, because you do have a kind of a list of things to do. I mean, all you need is like this one thing that takes too long. And now you're holding up all the guys behind you. So the real con for run loops and the evented type of asynchronous type things is the starvation issue, which the cooperative multi-threading also suffers from. That's really easy to do something that takes too long and everyone else suffers from it. And that leads me to GCD, Grand Central Dispatch. Have you been able to do much programming to GCD metal there, Andrew?
I've done some, yeah.
Okay, is that on Mac or iOS?
I believe what I've used it for is Mac.
Okay. Well, I'm a big fan of GCD. So it's funny, as we're going down this line, we're like, okay, imagine a process. Okay. Now, you know, process is an address space, a heap, at least one stack, and a set of registers. Well, then, forget the address space, we'll share that. We'll share the heap across things. So all you have is stack and register set. GCD kind of takes that to the next level. And that says, you know, a GCD task is basically, we'll supply the threads for you even. So all it ends up being is that it's not even a register set. It's just like this little chunk of state that lives on the heap. And we'll supply the address space, the heap, the register set, and the stack for you, right? Because it will walk up to your task. It has a GCD works by having a pool threads, and typically it's one thread per logical CPU, per logical core, and use it as a thread pool to wind through your task list. And this it provides a lot of the type of thread pooling infrastructure that non-trivial apps had to write themselves. It not only provides that, but it's deep down the kernel level, and that it can that the kernel is pretty aware about resource loads, whereas your app is pretty ignorant about it. And I mean, if your app were able to poll the system and to try and make policy-based decisions on that, it's you know, the kernel is all about doing this policy-based stuff and kind of load balancing. And so GCD pretty much puts the kernel in the driver's seat, and so it's like a total win, right? The kernel gets better control, gets an idea about what your program wants to do and what all the programs on the system want to do, and it can make these policy decisions more accurately. And it also provides a higher level API for you, because really you don't want to write thread pool crap code. You want to just say, hey, I have a list of tasks to do, go do them. And so it's pretty great. The one qualm I'll have with GCD is that Apple introduced, for a better lack of a better term, I'll call libdispatch, which is kind of the kernel part of Grand Central Dispatch, along the same time as it introduced blocks in Objective-C, and not just in Objective-C, but in C itself. And it tends to be really confusing when you talk to people. You're like, oh, you know, it's so weird. You know, so you do you use GCD? I'm like, oh, yeah, I use blocks. Well, actually, that's different.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of hard to talk about one without the other. But I am talking about basically the libdispatch side of things.
Well, now have you used GCD to schedule for scheduling tasks for apps of yours?
Yes.
Because the ones, I don't want to be spreading FUD or anything, but and this was a couple of years ago now, but I did see problems with trying to schedule too much work, too much concurrent work using GCD, that after a while GCD would kind of slow all your stuff down a lot because you were asking it to do too much with the given resources. And so even though in theory you were supposed to be able to basically throw anything at it and it would figure out the best way to do it, mm-hmm. in practice you had to throttle your own requests they went.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised about that. I did not run into that myself. Typically for the heavier type of stuff where I was really using it a lot, I tend to switch to NS operation.
Yeah.
But again, I think that would be the same issue because nowadays NS operation rides on top of GCD.
Is built on top of it, yeah.
Right.
I would be curious if any of our listeners had had more experience with this, because for me, my experience, again, a couple of years ago, really did negate a lot of that theoretical benefit of, hey, I don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. No, you still do. Which, you know what, makes some sense, because the idea of a technology which is going to free you from all constraints is probably a bit, dare I say it, Pollyanna-ish.
And, Pollyanna, that theme again.
So yeah, I'd be curious because, you know, I'd be curious about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I suspect my use of GCD and even NS operation probably has not been as heavy as probably you're running into. Mine tends to be kind of more making the UI keep on flowing even while the software is doing something. It's not too compute bound or resource bound. So I wouldn't be surprised.
That makes sense.
So I'm glad. See, there's supply at con there, a little potential seed of FUD there. But that's I have a few more cons of GCD. I would say there's a couple of design problems where it doesn't integrate well. I mean, GCD is great. I think it's great for what it is, and libdispatch is great. But it doesn't integrate with traditional Cocoa objects, like the Cocoa design patterns, like how you go about integrating GCD in it. It tends to be, well, it gives you callbacks into blocks. And how blocks integrate with traditional Cocoa objects, there's a bit of a mismatch there. And you, of course, the immediate thing that springs to mind is like, why don't you use NS operation, NS operation queue? And man, that's an episode in itself.
Now you have two problems.
it's pretty much, I can boil it down to saying, I really think NS Operation and NS Operation Q should not have been based on KVO. And I mean, yeah. KVO is not thread happy, and there, you have to do a lot of work for that. And those things are all about threads. So I think it's that was a probably the biggest problem with it. I have realized that you now can use a subset of the NS Operation and NS Operation Q API where you don't have to deal with KVO at all. In the original 10.5 API, you had to, or to get certain information out of it, but now you don't have to. So it might be possible to use a subset of that and keep everything sane. But I haven't delved into that myself yet. There's another API design issue, and specifically if you have a class that takes a block as a callback, like how do you invoke that block? Do you just straight up call it directly? Do you pass a queue along with a block? And then you dispatch it into the provided queue. It turns out that there are queue setup issues here. That if the queue was set up to be serial, or is it set up to be concurrent? There are ownership issues. Who owns the queue? And so there's a bunch of thorny issues there. And I don't think that's been really hashed out yet.
Yeah, no. Apple's APIs. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like. Like a lot of Apple's callbacks, they do send you the callback on the same thread that you called the API on, which is a nice bit of business, a nice way to keep things very simple. But that can be harder if you're just trying to handle it all yourself.
Right. I don't know if that's a explicit thing they're doing, or if that this how is this kind of shook out that because so much runs on the main thread already.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't heard one way or another. But probably the biggest problem with GCD is, again, not its fault. GCD is great for what it is. But, again, it's the problem where you have to explicitly add support for concurrency. That you have to break your code down to these blocks of code that can be executed concurrently. And, in some ways, we've been writing this monolithic serialization assumed code for a very long time, for decades. So, of course, we're not just going to be able to say, flip a switch and say, okay, make it concurrent. Although, supposedly these parallel compilers and vectorizing compilers keep on making those claims, but the real world examples I've seen win in certain cases, but I don't think this is something that where we just can throw software at to analyze our current software and turn into parallel. I think it's something that human minds need to do. And GCD is a great system for that, but again, it's something that you have to explicitly go. And I don't know if we have to rewrite our software for concurrency, whether GCD is something we should actually be targeting when there are higher level solutions to this. And speaking of higher level solutions, I have a bunch of them next up. So coroutines is a popular, by popular, I mean, no one uses them. I mean, they're popular in academia, but most commercial software, I would say most commercial developers, if you mention coroutines to them, they don't even know what they are. But essentially, you can think of coroutines, you know how like regular subroutines, you have a beginning and an end, you have like a return, and that's the end of your subroutine. Well, coroutines are just like, you can think of them as normal subroutines, but they have explicit suspend and resume points. So it's very much like that, the cooperative thread manager of macOS, classic macOS, where you have the yield to any thread. That is actually a suspend resume point where you can swap stacks and you can go from one task to another. And it's I used to be a much bigger fan of coroutines. Coroutines are lightweight and you can have a lot more than you can have threads. So they can share thread stacks. And so it can have a lot of them. The problem that was kind of raised in my mind was I was listening to an interview of Tim Caswell, who created I don't know what to call it. It's not a language. I would say it's a package, but it's called Love It. And basically, Tim took the Lua language and runtime, and he bolted it onto libuv, which is the async I/O library that powers Node.js. And now the interesting thing about JavaScript is that it does not have coroutines, but Lua does. And so he was able, so this is an ongoing flame fest in the Node.js community, that people trying to defeat callback hell by kind of making it look like threaded code in JavaScript. And JavaScript doesn't really have any direct support for this, but Lua does via coroutines. So he ended up, so now he has Lovett, and so he was able to actually write coroutine using code and seeing how this worked. And he actually prefers callbacks. I wouldn't go that far, but he did open my eyes to the fact that the problem with coroutines is that once you end up using them, if you use them extensively, they end up feeling like you're in a preemptive environment, because everything you call could end up calling yield behind your back, and you don't know when your stack is going to swap. So it's not preemptive in that someone is going to call yield very explicitly, but it tends to get out of your control, and it ends up feeling preemptive and with all the intended problems.
Well, and that feels like almost like exceptions, right? Anyone throw an exception behind your back.
Yeah, speaking of exceptions, that's my next point, is this thing called continuations. And so we have these control flow mechanisms. Obviously, we have if and for loops, and we have exceptions, all that, and even things like coroutines and threads. And so kind of the idea of taking this idea of program state and giving it a explicit object that you can control, that's what a continuation is. And so you can kind of think of it as like set jump, long jump from C on steroids that you can control. You can save a program state, and then you can invoke it later on very explicitly. And so you can basically build all control flow on top of this, including exceptions, including common list style conditions. And so problem is that they tend to be, they're so explicit. They're basically, you can think of them as programmable go-tos. So you can go anywhere, do anything, but that's a lot of power, and probably most programmers wouldn't know what to do with all that power. And so I'll just kind of move on. And getting close to my 45-minute mark, which I'm trying to keep under, and I think we're doing the functional. So functional programming is... it seems to be getting hotter and hotter to me. I don't know if it's just the circles I run in, but it seems. Have you heard the heat from the functional crowd?
I have. Well, you know, I'm learning Haskell, right?
Oh, so yeah,
I've been infected as well.
Okay, so then as a Haskell noob, you at least know the draw of the mutable data structures.
Right. Yes.
And you know, so the idea of the functional is so great. I like the functional, right? Is that, you know, it sounds so good. Is that you just declare your program functionally, and the runtime and the compiler will figure it out for you. And it's a beautiful model. The main thing, my main con I list for functional here, is that I don't know if I believe them. For a straight line code, functional seems very awesome, but for modern GUI apps, and I want to believe. I have that poster up on my wall, right?
Oh my god, I'm definitely seeing you with, you know, Haskell. I want to believe.
Yes, it's one of these. I'm misery on this, right? I want you to show me.
Well, I mean, if UI requires you to have side effects in order for things to happen. Yeah, how does it mesh with a program which is not supposed to, which bases its entire advantages on not having side effects?
Well, you actually fall right into my next point, which is, I know you've been studying Haskell, but have you been studying Clojure at all?
No.
Okay. So Rich Hickey did a great presentation at QCon London 2009, where he talks about program state in terms of identity and values. And I'll put a link on the show notes there. I highly recommend everyone watch this, because it's such a great presentation of... I think if you watch this presentation as a traditional imperative programmer, that it will change the way you look at software. So it's definitely worth 30 minutes to watch that. And so I think the Clojure's idea about identity and values, I think that might address the issue that you have with it would seem like modern GUI software requires side effects, but maybe it doesn't. So I don't want to go into it because I'm trying to run short on memory at the 45-minute limit, but I still want, I want to hit my one last bullet point.
Yes.
Okay. And my last bullet point, which is totally my pet bullet point here, is actors. And do you know what an actor is?
Yes, I do.
Other than Clint Eastwood?
Yeah, right.
I'm sorry, I caught it after the laughter. So do you know what actor is?
I have heard of the term. I have heard it described in the past. It's a couple of years now that people have been talking about it, yes?
Yeah. So it's fundamentally, it's like, so, you know, we're already very comfortable with the idea of sending messages to objects to get work done. And so an actor is just a little bit of an extension on that, is that instead of, when you send a message to an object, instead of it happening, the message code being invoked directly right then, is that the message gets put into a mailbox that the object has. So you can think of it like each object, every instance, has a little message queue. So you want to do something, you put an object in its mailbox, and what you get back is this little receipt. And this receipt, some people call them promises, some people call them futures. I prefer the promise terminology because I see people's eyes glaze over when you talk about unboxing futures. So this, think about promise. So it gives you back this receipt called a promise, and basically that's assuming that it actually wants a return result. But if you're just like saying, I want you to go do this thing, I don't care if it returns void, you're already done. But it might give you something back.
Dispatch async.
Pretty much, yeah. That's a good way to put it in GCD terms. And so every object has a little mailbox. And what's really cool about this small little extension is that you have no preemption worries because because you serialize everything through this little mailbox, this message queue. That means the code that's touching those instance variables by definition would be serialized. You also get fine-grained multi-threading for free. And I'm doing air quotes here, that you can't see. But if your entire system, and again, this is one of these boil the ocean problems, right? But if large parts of your system are implemented in terms of actors, then what you have is that you have objects sending messages to each other and queuing up responses, and allows the system knows very well in terms of what's waiting for what and when it can switch around, and allows the system to, if you want to do the cynical thing, you say, allows the system to deadlock very easily. But fortunately, modern actor systems actually have built-in deadlock detection. So hopefully that's less of an issue. But so the problem with preemptive multi-threading is that things change out from underneath you when you least suspect them. And you actually need a little bit more control than that. That's why we have locks. The problem with cooperative multitasking is that you have to explicitly yield. So what's cool about the actor model is that it's very fine-grained in that everything is, we're sending messages like crazy. I mean, if you look at the profile, obviously message send, it's always the number one, right? Because we're sending messages like crazy already. So that's a fine-grained thing, yet you don't have the preemption worries. And if you want to go theoretical on this, you can also say that it supports a transparent distribution in that actor does not need to be in your local process. It could be in another process, or it could be even on another machine. And that if you program your software using actors, that it supports both local software in one address space, and also supports it across, say, a grid or potentially even the internet. Of course, then we run into the entire issue that we talked about before, about the fallacies in the network or something like that. Well, I'll put a link to it when I remember it. But so I'm a big actor fan. But again, Rich Hickey actually has on the Clojure website actually has a pretty good criticism of actors, and I'll just put a link there because I'm already at 50 minutes. But I will say that of the 5 bullet points he lists there, that I only agree with one of them. So I think he has a different. He's actually tends to be talking about Erlang style actors. And the type of actors I'm talking about are, I guess, a bit different. Or, I don't know, maybe I like to say that he has a lot of experience with them, but my experience is different from his, so I don't know what the difference is. I'll have to ask him next time I see him. And that's pretty much it. I'm at 50 minutes. Sorry for my God. I know this is kind of like a straight line. Well, how serial of me, right?
You're right. If you could have just started talking about multiple topics, you know, at the same time,
dying, right? I mean, that's when you NS log for multiple threads. That's what you get, right?
Well, I do have to say that the actor stuff sounds a lot like making sure the runtime is cognizant of putting the information about multi-threading, object level multi-threading, into the runtime in the way that Objective-C already does with objects and messages, and in a way that we had talked about with ARC, that sort of ARC takes some of that back away. Mm-hmm. It takes it out of the runtime, puts it at compile time,
right,
usage. And that, yeah, it's kind of idea of taking the abstraction, you know, one step further, abstracting out even more, so that someone else can fiddle with all that stuff for you under the hood. Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I should also mention that Steve Dacord has posted Actor Kit on GitHub, which is basically an implementation of actors for Objective C.
Yeah. Is that what you've been using, or have you been doing something else?
No, I haven't been. I have not had the pleasure of using actors in a real system. So
okay.
All this has been academic stuff.
Hmm. Yep. Alrighty. Okay. So since we're trying to wrap things up pretty quick here, I'll just finish up.
Go ahead.
So you visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, our podcast on iTunes and more. And you can find us individually on Twitter, myself, A Pontius, APONTIOUS, and Wolf, his last name, Wrench. That's the word rent, RENT, plus C, plus SCH. So we'll see you next time.